from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today on the program, we look back at a grave anniversary. 10 years ago, a pipeline broke in the Kalamazoo River.
The water going over the rocks didn't sound like water going over the rocks. It almost sounded like a kid sucking on a super thick milkshake.
We'll also hear a report on how wildlife is faring a decade later. And we'll dive deep into the strange world of a confidence man. King James Strang, a self-professed Mormon king, ruled over Beaver Island.
You know, you read the diaries of the people who were there. They actually thought that, for better or worse, a king was being crowned. And again, it's easy to take this stuff sort of like as a joke. But I gotta say, like, the federal government didn't take it as a joke.
We'll also look at the parallels between the world of confidence men in 1850 and today. Those stories coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today we'll dig into the life of King James Jesse Strang, a self-professed Mormon monarch who held court on Beaver Island.
1848, which was a year where the world was just shaken with what seemed to religious people like omens of the apocalypse.
James Jesse Strang became the King of Confidence in Miles Harvey's book. We'll talk to him later on the program. But first, the worst oil spill into an inland waterway in U.S. history happened right here in Michigan 10 years ago this week. Michigan Radio's Rebecca Williams takes us back to that time and takes a look at what's changed.
It happened on a Sunday evening, 5:58 p.m. on July 25th, 2010. Enbridge's Line 6B was carrying a dark, thick oil from Canada's tar sands. The pipeline split open in a wetland near the small town of Marshall. Oil gushed into Talmadge Creek, then the Kalamazoo River, polluting almost 40 river miles. Enbridge estimated more than 840,000 gallons of oil spilled. The EPA put the amount at more than 1 million gallons. People who lived near the spill site, like Debbie Trescott, said there was an intense smell hanging in the air that Sunday.
I smelled this oil or gas or something. This was just horrible. It was just a horrible smell, and I knew then that something must be wrong.
But Enbridge did not realize anything was wrong for more than 17 hours. The control room operators were far away in Alberta. A federal investigation later found those operators thought they had a pressure problem in the pipeline. They shut the pipeline down twice. And twice, they restarted it, sending massive amounts of oil through the ruptured pipeline. 81% of the oil that spilled was a result of those mistakes.
The situation is very serious.
That's then-Governor Jennifer Granholm. People who lived nearby or spent time on the Kalamazoo River said the river ran black.
The water going over the rocks didn't sound like water going over the rocks. It almost sounded like a kid sucking on a super thick milkshake. I mean, it was just...
I think I can sum it up in one word, and that is nightmare. The smell, I don't even know how to describe the smell. There are no words. You could not be outside.
That was Craig Ritter and Deb Miller. Miller told us in 2011 she had health problems that lasted for months after the spill.
The headaches were just absolutely intense. I mean, watering eyes, the cough, it was chronic.
In late 2010, the state health department issued a report on acute health effects from the oil spill. The report says people in the area had headaches, nausea, and respiratory symptoms. In the early days, there was a major wildlife rescue effort. Turtles and muskrats and great blue herons were covered in oil. Rescue teams collected more than 2,000 birds and animals. Back then, herpetologist Dave Mifsud said turtles made up most of the wildlife rescued from the spill site.
We had some that were, their mouths were so tacky with the oil that they could barely open their mouths. So we saw some pretty devastating things.
The state is still monitoring the health of aquatic life in the area. The river reopened for recreation in 2012, but it took many years to clean up and restore the river. The main reason? The kind of oil that was spilled. Because it was so heavy and thick, a lot of it sank to the bottom of the river. Federal and state officials said that made the cleanup more difficult. 2 years after the spill, crews were still searching for oil on the bottom of the Kalamazoo River. Here's Mark Ducharme with the state's Environment Agency in 2012.
We're writing a book on how to clean up oil sands out of freshwater, cold water streams and in freshwater systems. We've been looking elsewhere. We've been trying to find other examples. They're just not there.
An investigation by the National Transportation Safety Board said the pipeline ruptured because of corrosion and cracking. It found that Enbridge was aware of six crack-like defects in Line 6B 5 years before the pipeline broke open, but did nothing to fix them. In a statement, Enbridge spokesman Ryan Duffy says the company transformed itself as a result of the spill. He says since 2011, Enbridge has invested more than $8 billion on maintenance, inspection, and leak detection across its crude oil pipeline system. And he says they've added staff to the control center and revised their procedures. Carl Weimer heads the watchdog group Pipeline Safety Trust. He agrees some things have improved since the Kalamazoo spill. But he says there's one major thing that has not changed in the past decade. Pipeline companies still do their own inspections.
You know, the regulators, when they say they inspect pipelines, they're inspecting the paperwork. They're not going out there and inspecting the pipeline for the most part. So you have to trust the companies, and you have to trust that the regulators are at least spending enough time on the paperwork and overseeing the company that there's some hope there.
And Weimer says Michigan could change its laws and ask the federal government for permission to take on more oversight of oil pipelines.
I'm kind of surprised that the state of Michigan hasn't done that.
Weimer says the spill also woke a lot of people up to the existence of the pipelines that crisscross our region.
Well, I think a lot of the attention you're seeing on Enbridge lines, Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, some of the tribal issues in northern Wisconsin, certainly the Line 5 now, it's all been heightened because of Enbridge's spill.
He says there is a lot more attention now to how pipeline companies assess their risks. But he says it's unfortunate that in the U.S., we often don't change laws or the way we do things until after a tragedy happens. For Stateside, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Full disclosure, Enbridge is one of Michigan Radio's corporate sponsors. There's a lot to see in the Upper Peninsula. The Great Lakes, vast wilderness areas, roadside attractions. Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Wanshura took a drive up to the UP recently, and he found something else that you should keep an eye out for.
I've just crossed the Mackinac Bridge, and I'm heading west on U.S. Highway 2 in St. Ignace. And I'm looking for something I was told would be just outside of town.
Oh, there it is. I'm going to pull over in this spot right here. Comes up on you quick.
Believe it or not, I've come to this part of Michigan to look at a billboard. Now, typically on billboards in this area, there are ads for McDonald's or a casino or maybe that famous UP mystery spot. Well, that's not what's on this one.
It's a girl with green hair, and she has wings coming out of her arms, and she's like beginning to fly.
Yes, a girl with green hair, and she's flying on the billboard.
And she's surrounded by these, like, kind of turquoise birds, and they're all taking flight together. And she's surrounded by flowers.
Katie Eberts is a freelance artist and illustrator from the UP. Katie painted this watercolor image. It's part of a collection she worked on while quarantined called The Strangest Dream.
So my series was, like, a bunch of, like, floating characters that are, like, upside down, and, like, nobody's upset, but they're like, what is going on, and how did I get here?
Which is a question you might ask when you see the billboard. What is going on, and how did this art get here? Well, enter Travis Ricks.
We're using consumerist infrastructure for culture, I guess.
Travis is one of the brains behind Save Art Space, a nonprofit that rents billboard ad space and turns it into public art. Besides Katie's, there are four other art billboards. They're all on US 2, and they stretch from St. Ignace to Gould City. Every one features Upper Peninsula artists.
And that's what we love, to find new places and experience the art and share the art with the people that live there that may have never seen it before.
The idea of turning billboards into public art spaces came to Travis Ricks around 2015. He was studying photography at the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan. And he noticed a lot of ads going up right over public art murals that had been painted in his Brooklyn neighborhood.
And you could still see the murals on the outside and the art still hanging out on the corners and stuff. And then in the middle of it is like an ad for Modelo or something. It's not what you want to see.
That's when he and a friend launched Save Art Space. Since it was founded, Save Art Space has rented billboards for art all over the country, L.A., Miami, New York City. Travis says they display art in public spaces because it's for everyone to enjoy, not just a select few.
I've worked in a gallery before in New York, and people would open the door just a little bit, stick their head in and say, "Can I come in? Is this for everybody? And I would always say, "Yeah, anyone can come in. There's no obligation to buy." And then they would just kind of look around real quick and leave. Like, they still didn't feel comfortable.
Just outside of Bob's Stop and Shop in Gould City, several more art billboards sit perched off the highway. One is a bit of an impressionist take on a beach landscape. Up the road to the west, another billboard shows the art of a wood-burning artist. It's a scene of an idyllic campsite in the woods. And keep in mind, they're huge. They're billboards, 22 feet by 11 feet. But do tourists like Scott Peterson see them?
I didn't, until you pointed it out, this one. I didn't know to look for them.
And what about David Miller? He lives right next to one.
Has that been something that you noticed?
No, I haven't. I don't usually head down that way. To me, it just makes it look nicer. So I'm just surprised.
Whether or not everybody actually sees the billboards on the side of the road doesn't seem to bother Travis Ricks very much.
Do you see it for 2 seconds? Do you see it for half a second? You see it, you stand outside like we are for 10 minutes? Everyone's going to have a different experience, and that's what we're going for.
Putting art up on billboards costs anywhere from $500 to $1,000 per billboard. Save ArtSpace covers most of that cost through fees from open calls for art submissions. Travis says he wants the art for each exhibit to reflect the taste and culture of the location. For instance, in Los Angeles, provocative photos exploring artistic nudity. That probably wouldn't be a great fit here in the Upper Peninsula. Which is why one of the billboards here is a painting of two mallard ducks.
They're just two ducks floating by each other. I think the title is called Friends in Passing, and it's perfect. It's beautiful. It represents the area, what you may see around here. I love it.
Some of the billboards could be up for months. Travis says that depends on when the next company rents the space and the commercial messages return. Meanwhile, as cars and trucks whiz by her billboard near St. Ignace, artist Katie Eberts looks up at her art. She's excited about the increased exposure she's getting and what that could mean for her and other UP artists. And she's got a message for you.
Slow down and pay attention a little bit, you know, because it's easy to just like go from point A to point B and just like stay with your tunnel vision. But I mean, it's a beautiful world and you should really like look around a little bit, you know?
I'm Dan Wanchura in St. Ignace.
Coming up, did you know Michigan once had a king? Well, sort of. The strange tale of King Strang of Beaver Island after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, filling in for April Baer. James Jesse Strang isn't exactly a part of Michigan folklore that we all know and discuss, but maybe he should be. The strange story of this self-professed monarch who held court in Michigan is almost too bizarre to believe, which actually falls in line perfectly with the world of confidence men, or con men, that he navigated in the mid-1800s. Author Miles Harvey documented the life and legacy of James Jesse Strang in his new book, The King of Confidence, a tale of utopian dreamers, frontier schemers, true believers, false prophets, and the murder of an American monarch. Before his book takes us to the wilderness of Beaver Island, we have to understand where James Strang even came from. Harvey sets the stage with his prologue titled In Which an Angel Watches a Man Fall from a Window in Illinois and Then Flies to Wisconsin with Pressing Business. Here's an excerpt. An angel watched the mob emerge from the woods and steal single file along an old rail fence toward the town jail. The instant before the assailants reached his room, the man readied a six-shooter smuggled in by one of his supporters. While the angel was no doubt able to peer through the walls of the jail and deep into the man's soul, his fears, his regrets, his thoughts about his rapidly dwindling time on earth, history can record only that his name was Joseph Smith, that he was 38 years old, and that he was the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Bullets ripped through the wooden door. Splinters flew. One of the other prisoners slumped to the floor, uttering, "I am a dead man." And now the mob pushed into the room. And now the one that they had come for fired his gun. and now his bullets were spent, and now he rushed to an open window, and now he flexed to jump, and now he was shot in the back, and then from below in the chest, and again in the back. "Oh, Lord, my God!" he yelled as he plummeted toward the earth. Let us stop here for a moment, frozen in time, arms outstretched, eyes wide open to take in his fate. And if the image of a doomed man suspended in midair seems somehow implausible, is it any less plausible than the rest of Smith's life? Is it plausible, for instance, that a down-and-out drifter, a person with only a rudimentary education, who spent much of his time hunting for buried treasure with a divining rod, who was described by those who knew him as indolent, ignorant, prevaricating, and shiftless, would be the one man singled out by God to found a new church, to produce a radically new holy book, and to ready the way for Christ's return to earth? Is it plausible, moreover, that despite the fact that the Book of Mormon was full of faulty grammar and anachronisms, despite the fact that even Smith's own hometown newspaper called it the greatest piece of superstition that has come to our knowledge, the man soon began gaining large crowds of enthusiastic followers? Indeed, as Smith completed the final plunge, the inglorious conclusion to his own story was about to institute the beginning of an equally epic and unlikely saga. Because even as the prophet hit the ground, even as his last words drifted across the plains, the angel was taking flight. With Smith dead, this celestial messenger had important business in Wisconsin. There, the angel came upon one of the local denizens, a short man with intense brown eyes. As the man would later report, the angel appointed his bald head with oil, sanctified him as the successor to Joseph Smith, and issued him a sacred commission. And then the angel disappeared, never to be seen again. History does not record this celestial messenger's name, nor does it establish whether he was an actual divine or a figment of the imagination or an outright lie. Only that the bald-headed man's name was James Jesse Strang, that he was 31 years old, and that much like Smith, he would rise from obscurity to fame, and that he too would meet a violent end. So with that, I'd like to introduce the author who wrote those words and documented the life of James Jesse Strang, Miles Harvey. Miles Harvey, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
The ability for him to feed into this life he was creating for himself, you describe a series of events that led up to it that made him that perfect man in that perfect moment. Can you talk a little bit about who he was before he became a Mormon?
Yeah. You know, one of the things we're blessed with is Strang's diaries from the time he was in his late teens until he was in his early 20s. What you find in those diaries is a guy who's both idealistic, you know, he has these kind of utopian thoughts even then, but wildly ambitious. You know, at one point in the diaries, he says, "If only I could meet, you know, Princess Victoria, later to be Queen Victoria of England, I would marry her and I would be king." You know, and this is not from a 10-year-old. This is from a young man who really believes he has a place in the world, right? But he also shows in these diaries like this cynical side. You know, he was an atheist and just a farm boy, but a really thoughtful farm boy and later a country lawyer. But he was a total atheist, but he knew the Bible really well. He was raised in the Baptist church. And he says at one point in the diaries, you know, "No one knows I'm an atheist. And when I talk about God, you know, people really like it. They really think I'm something else." And so you can see Strang the idealist versus Strang the opportunist early on. But it just didn't have he didn't have a way of expressing it in Western New York, where he grew up. He was kind of a failure at everything he did there. He was a lawyer and a postmaster and a newspaper writer. But then he moved to what was then the West, the wilds of Wisconsin, first of all. And there he could remake himself. And he did.
Especially because he chose Beaver Island as a place to be isolated, as you say. I would think going into this that Beaver Island had not been too inhabited before he got there. But in fact, the Anishinaabe were living there. The Odawa and Ojibwe Indians were starting to be pushed out at that time, or had begun to leave because of the the national government's desire for them to leave. What would it have looked like on the island when James Strang arrived?
Yeah, well, the as you say, there was a small native population on the island, and they just moved to a very nearby island when the Mormons came. And I'm not sure if Strang persuaded them to leave, or if they just said, you know, we can do just as well on this island. And there was a small population of European Americans there who quickly became enemies of the Mormons. You know, Strang basically ran a squatter kingdom out of Beaver Island. The Mormons paid for some of their property, but most of that property was federal land that they just took over. And he just, after a while, slowly but surely forced his enemies out and took over the island by, it appears, violence. And so the interesting dynamic in Beaver Island at that time is, as you point out, you've got sort of three marginalized groups. I mean, whatever else you want to say about the Mormons, they were a marginalized group in American society. You know, they had been forced by, at gunpoint, out of everywhere that they had lived. And now the mainstream Mormon church was moving west into uncharted territory. But there were also the Native Americans who were being pushed off their land. But then a lot of the other whites in the area were survivors of the Irish potato famine, which was just this unbelievably deadly and destabilizing thing with mass starvation and people forced to leave their country. So, I mean, I think one of the dynamics up there is that's just so interested me about this book was these three groups that, you know, just really are forced against each other by Strang's actions, it must be said, but really are just trying to get a toehold in American culture and American society and on the American map.
I want to talk more about the actual experience of Beaver Island and islands in general, the way that you describe them in your book. They were idealized then, as they are now in many ways, as places where you could forget yourself, your worries, the worries of the world around you, and also a place where you could indulge the sides of your life that you most wanted to live without fear of retribution from the outside world. And of course, for me, when I think of an island as a getaway and a place where you could just let go and not worry about the world around you, I'm thinking of Polynesia. I'm thinking of the Pacific Islands. I'm thinking of the Virgin Islands. I'm certainly not thinking of Beaver Island because that feels too close to home, right? But that's not how Strang saw it. He saw it as this sort of utopian place that he had envisioned since he was a kid. Talk more about that island draw for him.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've thought a lot about islands. My first book was called The Island of Lost Maps, which is about a cartographic criminal, a guy who went around stealing old maps, but it's sort of a meditation on maps. And one of the things map lovers know is medieval and even later maps, islands are full of myth. It's where we place our wildest fantasies. And so you'll see on these old maps all sorts of references to mythical beings, etc. And, you know, it's not coincidental that Thomas More, when he wrote Utopia, put it on an island. I think islands are this, represent to us a place where we can create new rules, where new things can happen. So I think Strang had that. He started a utopian colony in southern Wisconsin in a town called Burlington. It's about two hours northwest of Chicago. And, you know, it just kind of didn't go well for him there. His opponents didn't leave town after they quit the church, and his supporters kind of did leave town. So he was kind of just bleeding there. And so he realized he needed to isolate his people a little more. And there was this island in northernmost Lake Michigan, and he took him up there. And I think there was a sense of a kind of utopian getaway. But I'd point out two other things. One is that from modern cults, we know this need for isolation is paramount, you know, that the way you control a cult is you get people out of away from their families, away from their normal friendships and commerce, and you get them into a place where you can sort of indoctrinate them all the time. The other thing is, Strang was flat out running a pirate colony out of this island. Some earlier researchers have questioned that idea and said all the press reports about his criminal activity were just anti-Mormon bias. Well, there was plenty of anti-Mormon bias at this time, but I was able to document some situations that really offered much more solid proof that Strang was operating a large-scale criminal operation. He'd send people out to raid coastal towns and steal stuff, but also running a horse theft ring throughout the Midwest.
Talk about the events that were leading up to 1850 when Strang was crowned king in this coronation ceremony and what that ceremony also looked like.
Well, in 1849, he toured the United States with a young person named Charles J. Douglas, who he introduced to everyone as his nephew and personal secretary. Charles J. Douglas was actually a young woman by the name of Elvira Field, who was Strang's first plural wife and was traveling in secret with Strang. They didn't fool everybody.
It's just one of the wildest parts of the story.
In the book, there's a photograph of Charles J. Douglas / Elvira Field in men's clothing.
When I saw that picture, I just thought, well, that's a handsome young man. Why wasn't he leading this cult?
Yeah, kind of dashing, right?
Yep.
So, but in fact, and you know, Strang had run as the anti, or not run, he hyped himself as the anti-polygamy Mormon heir to Smith's church. But suddenly he had embraced polygamy. And so he moved full-time up to Beaver Island in the spring of 1850. And in the summer, he was crowned king in front of a couple hundred people. The throne was made of moss. He had a bunch of stage props they used. And then the Mormon, I think the women got together and, you know, sewed up a costume for him. And it's all rather comical when we think about it now. But I think at the time, you know, you read the diaries of the people who were there, they actually thought that for better or worse, a king was being crowned. And again, it's easy to take this stuff sort of like as a joke. But I got to say, like, the federal government didn't take it as a joke. President Millard Fillmore, about a year after Strang crowned himself king, was so worried about this quasi-independent kingdom on U.S. soil that he sent in the U.S. Navy's first iron-hulled warship to invade the island and bring Strang to justice. What's interesting is, although Strang was put on trial in Detroit in 1851, he and his people were found innocent on all charges. And when Fillmore left office kind of in disgrace in 1853, Strang was still king of Beaver Island. So he kind of outlasted a U.S. president and in some ways outsmarted him.
Was this still an era where an American president may have been feeling threatened by the idea of a monarchy in general?
That's a good question. You know, Fillmore was such an indecisive president that he could not decide what he thought about the great question of slavery and several others. And he had to sort of be talked into invading the island. And in the end, I'm not sure he would have done it again. It's hard to say why people saw Strang as a threat. But, you know, we have sort of a history of this. I mean, there are people now calling for, I mean, we just don't, there's something that makes especially politicians nervous about these sort of little enclaves that say we're not playing by the same rules as everyone else. And there's probably good reason for that. Whether Strang actually posed much of a threat to the sovereignty of the United States, I would say the answer is no, but that's just a guess. But he definitely posed a threat to the safety and the property of people in the Midwest.
Do you think that he was ever guided by a set of true beliefs, or was it more a belief in himself?
Now, that's the money question, Laura. When Joseph Smith was killed by a mob outside of Nauvoo, Illinois in 1844. Strang had only been in the Mormon church for a few months, and it's really unclear whether he was even a sincere member. By his own admission, he was an atheist going into his meeting with Joseph Smith. And, you know, he wasn't even in Nauvoo, which was then the Mormon capital on the Mississippi River, for just a few days, really. He didn't spend much time in Nauvoo. But after Smith was shot, he produced a letter from the prophet that claimed that he was a handpicked successor to Smith. And, you know, this was shocking to other members of the church. You know, he was this novice in the church, you know, he's barely a member. But Strang just had this incredible charisma. And he also just had the ability to fool people. And I just don't really know whether he ever believed he was a prophet. In any case, I think it kind of compares to maybe President Trump a little bit. This is just my opinion, but I think Strang was able to have a double consciousness where he knew he was lying to people, but thought, you know, my lies are okay because I am the person who can lead other people. I'm sort of the chosen one. And I think part of the thing that's interesting about him is just that he was so three-dimensional. For a writer like me, it's just wonderful to write about a guy who is so complex and intelligent and contradictory.
After the break, we continue our conversation with author Miles Harvey. We'll talk about what a story from 1850 tells us about today. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. We continue now with my conversation with author Miles Harvey. He wrote a biography about James Jesse Strang, who proclaimed himself a Mormon king and held court on Beaver Island. His book is called The King of Confidence. Well, knowing as much as you know about King Strang now, do you think that he would have viewed his activity as being criminal, or do you think he would have viewed it as justified because he was a king?
I don't know. And I think, again, it may have been a little bit of both. I think some of his people clearly thought, they had a name for it, consecration. They clearly thought, you know, we're bringing the second coming of Christ around. We cannot worry about human laws, and we cannot worry about whether those horses belong to you. We need them on Beaver Island. We've got important work. One of the interesting things about Strang, and it's, I don't think any previous researcher noticed this. He was they noticed his abolitionism. He was like, if he had one firm thing that he believed in, it was abolitionism, right? That was a really important thing to him. And, I noticed in the newspaper he ran off Beaver Island, I noticed an article one day by a guy named Fred Douglas, which was Frederick Douglas. This article was an excerpt from a book that an autobiography, one of Douglas's autobiographies that he just recently published. And I couldn't find it in any other newspapers in the country. So I think Strang got a hold of the book and printed the excerpt himself. And the excerpt is all about how sometimes theft is okay when you're an oppressed person. And I just thought, you know, this is just so Strang. You know, it's both this kind of progressive abolitionist view. I'm going to publish Douglas's piece, but it's also just so for his people. It must have been so self-justifying. Yeah, we're the oppressed. We get to steal that stuff.
A sense of self-victimhood.
Yeah, but and also just we have no choice. Yeah, I think it is self-victimhood. But it's also just, you know, we're doing this work. I mean, Douglas's piece is like this really challenging piece about, you know, when you're a slave and your only option for survival is to steal, you steal, right? Whether the people of Beaver Island had other options is another question entirely.
You know, it strikes me as we look at this book that Strang was sort of the perfect man for the perfect moment. Can we talk about the era that surrounded him, the sort of cultural climate that he was thriving in?
I love your description of the perfect man for the perfect moment. So let's talk about that moment first. This was a moment in history where the United States was undergoing immense change in all sorts of different areas. society was becoming much more mobile. There was a massive and destabilizing technological revolution with the telegraph, the telephone, the railroad, which just changed our notions of time and space. There had been a terrible economic disaster, the Panic of 1837, which was the worst crisis in America economically until the Great Depression. There were just huge political conflicts. This is the antebellum era, so it's the lead up to the Civil War. So it's a time when truth is just very malleable and when there aren't a lot of firm things to hold on to. And so James Jesse Strang came in and offered confidence, and people could trust him, although they couldn't trust him. And so he absolutely thrived in that era, like a lot of people like him, swindlers before and after. He was able to take advantage of this very unstable time and make people feel that he had simple answers to complex questions.
And there was a lot of anxiety that was sort of floating in the air, it seemed like, nationally and maybe on a global scale. People were worried about burgeoning wars and resistance movements around the globe, this economic anxiety you described. There's obviously a huge national strife going on between the northern and southern states that Strang himself was very cognizant of. There was also this apocalyptic sense that the world was about to end for humankind. And I just wonder if that made religious movements particularly powerful at the time.
I think that's absolutely right. So 1848, which was right, it's a couple of years before Strang declared himself king, but well after he had built a large following as a prophet, was a year where the world was just shaken with what seemed to religious people like omens of the apocalypse, revolutions in Europe, famine in Ireland, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And many people during this time were pretty sure that they were in the end times. And, you know, Strang was a Mormon. And in fact, the early Mormon church was a fairly apocalyptic church. You know, they thought that they were ushering in the second coming, probably during their lifetimes. And so for the people in Strang's utopian colony, that must have just been incredibly seductive to think that, you know, you're bringing around the resurrection of Christ and you're doing really important work. And when you've been kind of the loser in the massive, you know, changes of the mid-19th century, that must have been even more seductive, right?
You know, I couldn't help as well seeing all this symmetry between some of what we're experiencing now on a national global scale, and you referenced with our president as well. When you were writing this book, did you feel that as you were writing it, or was the story writing itself just because the historical documentation was just so rich?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, my work on this book overlaps almost exactly with President Trump's candidacy, election, and presidency. And I could not help but notice strong comparisons between our unstable times and how certain people are able to take advantage of them and bend the truth their own way, and Strang's times. So I think I would have written a different book in a different time. You know, I'm grateful to Strang for helping me understand Trump, and I'm grateful to Trump for helping me understand Strang. In the book, Trump is not mentioned, nor is our current time. I made one oblique reference in the beginning and one oblique reference in the end, and then I just left it to readers to compare to connect the dots. And I'm glad to say they have. I mean, it's been really interesting to see from the start how many readers and critics are saying, you know, this book is kind of a parable for our own times. And in some ways, it helps us think through our own times. And that's really similar to my experience as a writer. So I'm glad readers are getting that out of it.
Well, I think one of the things that was very easy to extrapolate for a modern context is when things become very uncomfortable, we turn to these confidence men or con men to help us navigate the small or the large, and allow ourselves to buy into something that is fantasy because it feels more secure than reality. And I think that's kind of where it became glaringly obvious how what people were going through at that time reflects today. And I think that for me as a reader, it's like, okay, well, those people didn't go through the apocalypse. They actually came out the other side, and there was a little bit of a breath of fresh air that, you know, we can make it through some of the most harried times in human history.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I always say is when my friends say, you know, we are living in the most divided time ever in American history. You know, we are so polarized. I'm like, you know, we had a civil war, and the decades leading up to it, we were much more divided and I think much more unsettled. But I think your point about Strang is spot on, that he offered this sort of fantasy that was really attractive to people. And, you know, I sometimes wonder if that's not that there aren't all sorts of con men all over the world, but that's a particularly kind of American thing. You know, Charles Dickens came again to the Midwest in 1842 and was struck by people's attraction to people they knew were lying to them, right? So there was Dickens talked to people about what Americans called smart men, right? Men who just tell the big lie, you know, who would rip people off without shame, who would just really warp the truth. And when Dickens would ask him about him, they'd say, well, he's a smart man. You know, that guy's got something on the ball. He's really able to con people. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't want to claim it as an American thing, but this kind of character has been with us a long time.
That's so interesting. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking now with author Miles Harvey, who documented the life of James Jesse Strang, or King Strang, of Beaver Island in his new book, The King of Confidence. What do you think allowed James Strang to thrive on the island and that broke down and led to his downfall?
Well, you know, I think Strang was one of those people who's more attractive the less you know him and less attractive the more you know him. Like a lot of, you know, would-be prophets or would-be saviors of any kind, political or otherwise. I think polygamy, like a lot of people came to the island, Mormons left mainstream Mormonism and came to the island because Strang was vocally opposed and said, I will never change on this. He was very opposed to polygamy, but then he quickly switched to polygamy and ended up, he had five wives when he was murdered in 1856. The ostensible reason for his opposition, one of the big reasons was that he made all women on the island wear pantaloons. Those are like pajama pants, basically. And like many things with Strang, this was it's fun to write about because the gender relations on the island were so complex. In one way, it's very progressive, right? So women on the island were wearing pantaloons a year before Amelia Bloomer, the famous women's rights advocate, donned them, and they became known as bloomers, we call them today, right? They became this big symbol of, you know, proto-feminism. And so, the bloomers also caused a lot of rancor on the island. And, you know, I think it's probably much more complicated than that. I have to say, I think it's a lot like the wearing of masks is today. So if you wore bloomers, you were showing your support for Strang. And if you refused to wear bloomers or refused to let your wife wear bloomers, you were showing your opposition to Strang. Like the mask or the Confederate flag for that matter is today. It's this symbolic thing. But eventually the opposition grew stronger and stronger. And in 1856, an all-out plot was underway to murder Strang.
He is shot several times, but he survives for, I think, 2 or 3 weeks. One of the things that struck me most after he died was that Elvira Field, one of these wives that you discussed, she is aghast that he doesn't return from the dead. And she believes that he is going to rise. Like anybody believes, any Christian believes that, you know, Jesus is going to return, so too would James or King Strang, I suppose. I don't know how to say I found that a little bit mind-boggling, because you would think that a wife who was as close to him as Charles Douglas / Elvira Field would have been very cognizant of the confidence game that he was playing all along. But she seems to have bought into it just as fully as his most devout followers.
I mean, she's one of the other of many fascinating figures. You know, he surrounded himself with true believers and with con men, and often the same person was both things. So Elvira was this figure who, for months, not a day, not, you know, a couple of days, not a week, wandered around the East Coast with him in men's clothing and said, "Hi, my name is Charles J. Douglas." So she had a little bit of con woman in her as well, clearly. And she clearly was willing over the long haul to pull it off. And she also, after a while, knew that her brother was back in Michigan searching for her everywhere. She didn't tell her family. So she knew that people were suffering as a result of her scam. But I think she also really believed him to be, you know, divine, a conduit to God. She always said whenever he asked her to do something, she believed that it was God inspired. And so I guess I don't find it so hard to believe. I mean, the other thing is this period of history just has such religious enthusiasm. I mean, there were all these groups running around, and utopian enthusiasm, and they were often the same. One of the great things about writing about Strang was just the wildness of his times. And, you know, that's what drew me to this book. I mean, I just saw him as a lightning rod for all that craziness, all the apocalyptic fevers, all the enthusiasms, even some of the great progressive movements, you know, abolitionism, the women's movement. He sort of, you know, in a way just was part of all of that. You know, one of the things that I just loved about writing this book was the opportunity to work on such a contradictory character. You know, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction, you yearn for someone who's, you know, pops in three dimensions. And boy, James Jesse Strang really did that. So it's been, I can't always say I would ever want to hang out with him much, but it's been a joy to be in his presence as a writer.
Miles Harvey, his new book is The King of Confidence, A Tale of Utopian Dreamers, Frontier Schemers, True Believers, False Prophets, and the Murder of an American Monarch. Miles, thanks so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Thousands of people are singing about the man on the flying trapeze. I am the only one in the world who knows who he really is. Listen.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's show was produced by Mike Blank and April Van Buren, with help from our interns Leah Baldori, Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our director is Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Laura Weber-Davis. April Baer will be back next week. Thanks so much for joining me. It's been fun. Have a good weekend.
Oh, he floats through the air with the greatest of ease. I pray that someday while he's up there he'll sneeze and fall down and ruin his flying trapeze. So my love will come back to me. Here's how his trapezing act would begin. First, he'd balance himself on the bar with his chin. That proved that his real art was a violin. I figured it out by his whiskers. So I snuck in his tent one fine evening. Aha! And his bearded disguise I pulled off. And I found that this man on the flying trapeze was that...